chances, you won't be denied. But my heart is where it's always been. My head is somewhere in between. Give me one more chance, let me be a lover tonight. Welcome to It's an Arsenal Thing. I'm your host Tom, and with me is the High Priest of Inactivity. He's a bastion of impropriety and a man who holds the record for eating the most onion bargees in a single sitting, washed down with a quart of Kingfisher Lager. It's Silent Dave Hutchinson. Stephen Nash wants us to discuss why referee Paul Tierney, who lives in Manchester, just 5 miles from the Old Trafford ground, was appointed to officiate the game. We will. We're happy to oblige. That's what we're here for. Did you also know that VAR ref Lee Mason hails from Greater Manchester? Not the result we expected or deserved, but we move on. What a transfer window. Records fell left, right and centre. Premier League clubs have a net spend of over £1.9 billion in this year's transfer market, according to transfermarket.co.uk. This beats last season's total of £1.44 billion and also the £1.86 billion spent by clubs in a 2017-2018 season. Chelsea made history by spending £271 million. Well, 271.1 million. Also 0.1 of a million. No other Premier League side has spent as much money during a single window.
What's on the show tonight?
Calm down, you enthusiastic sausage. On the menu tonight, Connor reports on the game against Erik ten Hag's cash-happy Manchester United. What's your name?
Pedro Gonzalez Taramasalata.
You look good in shorts, and we like your haircut. 60 million and not a penny more. Start fixing your ground. It looks like a rusty, oversized bucket. We dip into the Arsenal archives. Lauren brings us up to speed with the WSL, and we look ahead to the opening match against Manchester City. We reveal which club's fans top the biggest drinkers chart and who has the cheapest bar. This is what they want, frugal news. Connor's back with a player profile on the ever-dependable linchpin of Arsene Wenger's Arsenal side from 2013 to 2019. It can only be Nacho Monreal. There's the gun room with Jay, Mitch and Paul to discuss the game and its talking points, plus the transfer window. Was it an A-plus or a C-minus? We feature comments from social media and your emails. We reveal which Arsenal player has scored the most home goals out of Liam Brady, Mikel Arteta and Cesc Fabregas. Acrobeto is back on the pod with his unique presentation style that includes references to West Ham Limited. And we tell you who holds the record for jumping the highest in football. There's a musical interlude and, of course, all the usual nonsense. But first, courtesy of Dave Miller, Arsenal Football Attic. Aaron Ramsey made his Arsenal debut 14 years ago. He was signed from Cardiff City as a 17-year-old and spent more than 10 years at Arsenal. 371 appearances, 65 assists, 65 goals. I remember many a late thunder into the box by Aaron Ramsey. And he also picked up 3 FA Cups. Cast your mind back to 2003. 6 Arsenal players were charged by the FA after the infamous Battle of Old Trafford, which took place on the 21st of September. The feisty contest, littered with incident and bad feeling, finished 0-0, but that wasn't the end of it. Patrick Vieira was sent off for 2 yellow cards in 3 minutes in the final phase, but the most famous incident in the game saw a penalty miss by Ruud van Nistelrooy that saw Martin Keown screaming and shouting at the Dutchman. The Arsenal players felt that van Nistelrooy had overreacted to the captain's challenge and was key to his sending off. Following the game, 6 Arsenal players were charged, while only 2 from United received any charge at all. It appeared that the FA were quite happy to let United, under Ferguson, do whatever they wanted. The club was fined £175,000, Keown was fined £20,000 and given a 3-match ban, Lauren was fined £40,000, Patrick Vieira and Ray Parlour were given fines of £20,000 and £10,000 respectively and were banned for 1 game, and Ashley Cole was fined £10,000. We don't care about that.
Phil Neville, on the other hand, who tried on several occasions to decapitate and maim assorted Arsenal players, went home like a rosy-cheeked cherub with his bank balance intact, and he slept soundly. The Nevilles, if surprised-looking ferrets ever took a human form. Right, it's time to go to Connor and going to get into it part one. Connor covers the clash between Manchester United and Arsenal from Old Trafford. We weren't looking forward to this.
Well, it simply had to come eventually, I suppose, didn't it? To all those Arsenal fans dreaming, perhaps prematurely, like myself, of a repeat of our invincible season, I'm sure you all feel like it was an extra bitter defeat on Sunday afternoon, seeing as we lost to Manchester United at Old Trafford and played so well for prolonged periods of the game. The good news though, Pep City surprisingly dropped points for the second time this season, which means despite our first loss of the Premier League campaign, we're still top of the lot. But now we're just a single point clear of City and Tottenham, and now just 3 points ahead of a resurgent fifth-placed Manchester United. It finished on Sunday afternoon at Old Trafford, Manchester United 3, Arsenal 1. The result definitely flattered Ten Hag's United. Arteta's men fought well and really dominated for large periods of the game. The result was certainly not what our performance deserved, but Arteta will be left frustrated at how open we were at the back sometimes. It made us extremely susceptible to being punished by Manchester United counter-attacks, and we were on 3 occasions. United's 3 goals coming from 3 counter-attacks, 3 pivotal occasions in the game. Marcus Rashford is seemingly getting somewhere near his best once again, and he was just too quick and too sharp at times up top for the home side. Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag deserves a lot of credit for putting Rashford as the number 9 and believing in the English forward. It worked really, really well on Sunday evening, unfortunately for us. As for Arteta, well, I'm not too sure if he had planned and instructed a high defensive line, but it was a naively dangerous tactic, especially with the likes of Fernandes and Rashford at United's disposal. A really disappointing defensive performance in my eyes from what was a pretty impressive Arsenal back four coming into Sunday's showdown. Well, we now turn our attention to European football as we kick off our Europa League campaign on Thursday evening as we travel to Switzerland to take on FC Zurich in the first round of fixtures in Group A's group stage. Well, the match report then, and our first loss of the season. So strange for me to be actually providing you a match report of a loss. But there you have it then. Team news, and Oleksandr Zinchenko was once again fit to take a left-back role, and Tierney dropped to the bench. We started on the back foot, but had the ball in the back of the De Gea's net in the 12th minute. Odegaard tussled with Eriksen for possession, before Saka played a perfectly weighted through ball for Martinelli to run onto, and our Brazilian Martinelli slotted home brilliantly what would have been his 4th league goal of the season. But a VAR review deemed that Odegaard had fouled Christian Eriksen in the build-up. It was, in my view, an incredibly soft call. Odegaard said so in his post-match press conference as well. Arteta was fuming, but Odegaard did make contact with Eriksen. The question is, though, was the Danish midfielder already falling to the ground before Odegaard robbed him? Anyway, a 50-50 decision didn't go our way, but we controlled the next 20 minutes or so without threatening De Gea's goal. United then took the lead in the 35th minute against the run of play. Eriksen played a superb ball into the feet of the classy Bruno Fernandes. Gabriel was reckless and showed signs of rashness and immaturity as he rushed out of position to chop the Portuguese playmaker down. Jadon Sancho then picked up the loose ball as the referee allowed advantage to be played. Sancho found Rashford on the edge of our box, and with his back to goal and Gabriel out of position, Zinchenko rushed over to try and nip it off Rashford, leaving Antony the time and space to slot past Ramsdale for his first goal for the club on his official Manchester United debut in front of the home fans. Brilliant moment for Antony. Poor from Gabriel and Zinchenko though, and at half-time it was Manchester United 1, Arsenal 0. But Arteta's men started the second half on the front foot, and deservedly we had got our equaliser on the hour mark. the once again exceptional Martin Odegaard slipped a delightful through ball for Gabriel Jesus with his weaker right foot. The Brazilian's blocked shot fell kindly to Bukayo Saka on the edge of the area to tap in the rebound. It was Saka's first league goal of the season, and from that moment onwards, I expected us to go on and get the win, but we were caught napping at the back once again 6 minutes later as United scored on the counter-attack again. Bruno Fernandes picked up the ball in a pocket of space before threading a typical Fernandes through ball for Rashford to chase with the outside of his foot. Superb pass by Fernandes. Rashford too quick for Saliba. The English forward, despite Ben White's best efforts, swept past Ramsdale into the far bottom corner to make it 2-1 to United. Emile Smith Rowe, Eddie Nketiah, and a first appearance for Fabio Vieira in the 74th minute. Couldn't change the game as moments later, United wrapped up victory. Christian Eriksen was somehow put through on goal with the simplest of through balls, and the midfielder raced through on goal and squared unselfishly for Rashford to seal the win. But where were our defence? We were caught cold once again, and our 100% unbeaten winning start to the Premier League campaign came to a crushing and devastating end at Old Trafford. It's Everton at home this Sunday at the Emirates in the Premier League as we look to bounce back and get back to winning ways and keep top spot of the Premier League. But it finished at Old Trafford on Sunday evening. Manchester United 3, Arsenal 1.
So which club's fans are known for propping up the bar and guzzling down a pint? Let's just nip down to the Trust the Process Arms, a busy pub in the village of Great Expectation in Sussex. Well, surprisingly, it's Brentford FC. They lead the way, topping the charts as the Premier League's biggest drinkers, with 41% of fans drinking 5 pints or more on game day. Arsenal fans aren't far behind with 34%, and that bags them the runners-up title. Let's have a look at the price of a Premier League pint, from the cheapest up to the most expensive. You have to allow that the Premier League price table that we're about to tell you may have been influenced somewhat by a price rise. The least expensive pint comes from Man United. Old Trafford, bring your own glass, it's only £3. Liverpool is £3.30, Bournemouth at £4.25, Everton at £4.55, Man City £4.60, Newcastle £4.90. Let's go to the top of the table on those greedy clubs with those greedy directors, those fat suited directors sat in their swivel chairs. Chelsea, £5.70 a pint. Leicester, £5.80 a pint. What's that? To forget that you've just watched them play. Fulham, £5.80. Arsenal, oh, shame on you, £6.35. West Ham, top of the pile, £7.30. Can you believe it? While we're talking about beer, don't forget to nip down to the Tollington Arms or the Tolly, the Gunners Pub and the Arsenal Tavern on the way to and from the ground for something wet, wonderful and frothy. And why not have a beer while you're there?
It's an Arsenal thing, it's an Arsenal thing. Believe it or not, it's an Arsenal thing. With football and transfers, you know you'll bring. You're listening to It's an Arsenal Thing.
Who scored the most own goals? Is it Mikel Arteta, Cesc Fabregas or Liam Brady? We will tell you after this.
Arsenali, Arsena, Arsenali, Arsenali, Arsena, Arsenali. Million Muli, Niwa Arsenali, Kasavuli, Niwa Arsenali, Juwa Kali, Niwa Arsenali, Mohamed Ali, Niwa Arsenali, Rogo Mandeli, Niwa Arsenali, Atu Wali, Niwa Arsenali, Van Persie, Beefu Wali, Niwa Arsenali.
We don't go lie, the plan we have this time is to win the league and carry the trophy home. You my new fans, you better be prepared. You took command and now you have to pay. We could deal with you.
Arsenali, Arsena, Arsenali, ah. Arsenali, Arsena, Arsenali,
we could deal with you.
Lakini, Arsenali, our African, finally. Aye. Arsenali, Arsena, Arsenali, Arsenali, Arsena, Arsenali, Arsenali, Arsena, Arsenali, Arsenali. Thank you.
We asked you who scored the most own goals out of Liam Brady, Cesc Fabregas and Mikel Arteta. Well, Liam Brady and Cesc Fabregas had one apiece, and Mikel Arteta, Spanish Michael, comes in at the top with two. That's according to worldfootball.net. Right, it's time for Gonna Get Into It, part two with Lauren, as we build up towards the opening game of the WSL season against Manchester City.
Finally, it is here. The WSL gets underway this weekend, starting on the 10th of September with United taking on Spurs. Arsenal's WSL campaign begins a day later, on Sunday the 11th, as they face last season's third place Man City at the Academy Stadium, Manchester. It could potentially be a season-defining match for both teams, so let's have a look at how they fared last season, how they got on during pre-season, and what we are likely to see on Sunday. I'm Lauren, and as always, it is a great pleasure to be reporting on the Arsenal Women for It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. So without further ado, let's get into it. So what did last season look like for both clubs? Well, Arsenal finished above City, who had their lowest league finish since 2014. This was mostly due to a horrendous start, with many of their key players out injured, forcing others out of position to cover. We faced off pretty early last season as well. It was late September. Arsenal came away as the 5-0 victors in that. However, as the season went on, City found their stride and were able to hold the Gunners to a 1-1 draw in January. That was the last time these two faced each other. Overall, they've played a total of 24 times, of which City have won 12, Arsenal 10, and twice the match has ended in a draw. Preseason this year began at various times for different players, some of whom were late joining because of their involvement in the Euros or Copa America, for example. Others faced further delays because of injury or fitness doubts. Not much was said about Arsenal's preseason, to be completely honest. Most of it was kept pretty tightly under wrap, apart from a few videos and pictures from a week-long training camp at Adidas headquarters in Germany. All games were held behind closed doors. That being said, it was reported that we admittedly suffered a humiliating 5-0 defeat to the under-15 boys. Yes, Arsenal's under-15 boys bet the Arsenal women's first team. Now, another honourable mention is Katie McCabe, who captained Ireland to a 1-0 win over Finland. They finished second in their group, ensuring their playoff spot for what could be their first World Cup competition. Very exciting. So turning our attention to City for a moment, I've actually seen more of them than Arsenal this summer. Brief bit of context on the Women's Champions League. It is a 16-team competition. It's a lot smaller than the men's, and only the best of the best qualify. Despite finishing third and second respectively, City and Arsenal still had to play to qualify to get into the Champions League. Arsenal's second round draw has not yet been played, but we know they will face Ajax. On the other hand, City were drawn against Real Madrid in the round one group of qualifiers. How did that go? Not good, if you're a fan of the Blues. In the one-legged tie, City were knocked out of the competition before it ever really began. One goal was all that was in it, which was scored in the 15th minute by Caroline Weir, a name very familiar to City supporters. The Scottish international left City in July only to knock them out of the exact competition she'd failed to reach in her time playing with them in August. Ouch. Unfortunately, that's only one of many departures from the City side this summer. Lucy Bronze has joined Barcelona, Giorgio Stanway has gone to Bayern Munich, and there is a lot of speculation over Kira Walsh's future, who might be the next to leave. She is heavily linked with Barcelona. As well as that, two England icons in Ellen White and Jill Scott have hung up their boots, literally, both retiring on a high, but to the surprise of many. Goalkeeper Karen Bardsley has also retired, leaving the City squad a shell of its former self. Now, they have got in a lot of players as well, but only time will tell how that goes. So what can we expect from our opening fixture? I imagine given the huge changes to the City team, it will take them some time to gel. An ill-timed international break this week is also something that both teams have to contest with, but I am pretty confident in an Arsenal win. I'm going to go with 3-0 to the Arsenal. Hopefully Beth Mead is firing early for us. The match will be shown on Sky Sports at 7 p.m. on Sunday, so there's no excuses to miss it. Another game to keep an eye on this weekend is last season's champions Chelsea, who take on West Ham. You would expect a comfortable Chelsea win there, as they really are the team to beat this season. But it's the opening day and no one knows how it's going to go. That's all for me this week. Next episode, I'll be discussing the drama from our opening weekend, and we will have a look at the Arsenal-Brighton game, which takes place on Friday the 16th. See you then.
He's back, the world's greatest sports presenter. Acrobeto, we love him here on the pod. This is from a few years ago. Let's set the scene. Our favourite Ghanaian is in the studio announcing up-and-coming fixtures in the Premier League and the Bundesliga. There's the odd tricky name like Sheffield United and even West Ham. But it all goes horribly wrong when he goes to the Bundesliga with a game involving Eintracht Frankfurt.
Now, sports. Bola, eba bono abrochire. English Premier League. Eye English Premier League no. Wanga eba bono fixtures na mpeze me kikache bono.
Sheffield United, bit tricky.
St. Louis United versus Manchester City. Burnley versus Chelsea. Liverpool versus West Ham Limited.
West Ham Limited.
Germany. Bundesliga. Where's your Germany? Bundesliga. Ha.
Here we go. Wait for it. You can do this. Come on.
And tick. Viewers, apologize. I'm continue. This German Bundesliga league. And Frankfurt versus Werder Bremen. Yes.
Here's one of those facts that you just think, why are you telling me that? Who has jumped the highest? Well, you won't be surprised to learn it's Ronaldo, who measured a jump at 8.39 feet, which is higher than the actual height of a crossbar, which is 8 foot. This magnificent feat has led many to claim that Ronaldo's jump is as good as any average NBA basketball player, and his air time, the amount of time he spends in the air, was as good as the great Michael Jordan. But hold on a minute, 25-year-old Motherwell Ugandan international defender Beavis Mugabe has even beaten Ronaldo's world record by an inch. He raced up for a corner and rose to a stunning 8'6" to head the ball in the back of the net. That's from Sports Bible. Connor's back with a player profile on Nacho Monreal.
It is that time again then, and our second player profile to bring you of this season's It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. And well, what a player to talk about today, Nacho Monreal. His full name, if you didn't know, Ignacio Monreal Eraso. He was born on the 26th of February, 1986, in Pamplona, Spain. The 36-year-old former Arsenal left-back announced his retirement from football on the 16th of August of this year. For me, Monreal was what I would describe a very tidy, reliable and professional fullback. He seemed like one of those players that simply got on with it and played whenever and wherever he was asked to. He certainly struck me as quite the humble character during his footballing career and seemed no different off the pitch. He was quite a versatile defender and when needed regularly slotted in at centre-back for Wenger when the Frenchman had no other available centre-halves at his disposal. Monreal, whilst not the strongest physically, more than stood his ground when deployed in that unfamiliar role at the back for us. He earned 22 caps for the Spanish national side, scoring one goal, earning his first call-up in 2007 at the age of 21. And well, Monreal started his professional playing career with the youth team of Spanish side Osasuna, his hometown club, before going on to make his full debut for the club at the age of 20 in October 2006. In a 1-0 away loss to Valencia in La Liga. the extremely consistent and perhaps underrated left-back, would then go on to make 126 more appearances for Osasuna before signing for Malaga for around £5 million in the summer of 2011. He netted three times for Osasuna, whilst just managing the one goal in his 45 appearances for Malaga during his year and a half spell at the club. He played a crucial part in Malaga's fourth place finish that year, helping them qualify for the Champions League for the first time in the Andalusian club's history. He actually scored his first and only goal for Malaga just 4 days before his move to North London in Malaga's 3-2 away win at Mallorca. Well, Arsene Wenger made a move for Nacho in 2013, snatching him up for roughly £8.5 million in the January transfer window. He actually signed on transfer deadline day and was a regular under Wenger and almost ever present in the side during his 6-year stint with us. He could be seen wearing the number 17 shirt and made his official debut for us just 2 days after signing in a 1-0 home win over Stoke City at the Emirates. Monreal would provide his first assist for the Gunners in a 2-1 win against Aston Villa just 3 weeks after joining, setting up fellow countryman Santi Cazorla's eventual match winner. In what was to be a very impressive start to his Arsenal career, Monreal then scored his first goal in an Arsenal shirt, scoring the first in our 2-0 away win at Swansea City on the 16th of March 2013. His number 17 shirt then was given to Alexis Sanchez upon the Chilean's arrival to North London in the summer of 2014, with Monreal given the number 18 heading into the 2014-15 season. He enjoyed another strong season that term, scoring the first goal in our 2-1 FA Cup quarterfinal win at Old Trafford on the 9th of March 2015, of course. We then subsequently went on to lift our first trophy in 10 years, a 4-0 thrashing of Aston Villa, giving us FA Cup glory. Monreal notably won PFA October Player of the Month in 2017. He returned to Spain on the 31st of August 2019, with the 33-year-old joining Real Sociedad on a 2-year contract. He scored his first competitive goal for Real Sociedad on his competitive debut just 2 weeks later. But unfortunately, Monreal then missed the entire 2021-22 season due to a debilitating knee injury. What a player though, Nacho Monreal, 2013-2019 for the Gunners. And well, of course, he retired earlier in August of this year at the age of 36.
It's time to enter the gun room for a natter.
Hi, welcome to the gun room. With me, I've got a full house. It's the Pocketeers. We've got Mitch. How you doing, Mitch?
Not too bad. Good to be back.
We got Jay. How you doing, Jay?
All good, thank you. All good.
And we got Paul, our token toffee. It's all going to be good coming up, isn't it? Eh?
It's going to be really interesting. I just wish I was in Naples tonight. That sounds like a really good game. Football meetings for me to watch.
Right, we'll have a brief word on the Villa game. There's lots to get through. We've got the transfer window, we've got the Villa game, the Man United game, and we've got the emails and social media as well. So, Aaron Lerner of Subnation said, I was a bit perplexed why their results had been so poor over the last 15 matches. He's talking about Aston Villa, obviously. Just 3 wins from 15. They had good players, but after watching them play today, everything is cleared up. They don't play football. Steven Gerrard sends them out to try and kick opponents up into the air. Before I read that, I thought myself that it was getting a bit tasty. You had McGinn and Ramsey. It was a lot of argy-bargy. How did you see it, Mitch, on the physical side before we get to the match?
I mean, I kind of agree with a lot of what Aaron said in that. I think that Aston Villa has a lot of talented players that just are clearly not being utilized correctly. I had higher hopes for Steven Gerrard after winning the league and winning the SPL with Rangers when he came into that Aston Villa job, especially with like the amount of talent that they had and that they do have on paper. But yeah, they've been going into these matches and just trying to be like a physical presence, and it's not doing enough in order to like have them to be able to get out results. And yeah, it got kind of awful in our game where like, I feel like there's been multiple games now where we've seen like a lot of different, like a lot of physicality and a lot of tackles against Arsenal players that just like hasn't been punished. Where it's just like over and over and over again. And it's like, well, then I'm going back to Xhaka.
You're not talking about Tyrone Mings, are you?
Oh, I'm definitely talking about Tyrone Mings, who is just awful.
Scrum half, isn't he?
Like, he just, in the last two Arsenal games, an Arsenal player has been picked up and thrown to the ground. And I don't know how that's allowed. I mean, granted, Scott McTominay got a yellow card for it, but Tyrone Mings was not punished whatsoever. So it's very weird that this keeps happening. And yeah, I think Aston Villa is generally trying to do stuff like that. And they have the players to play a better brand of football, and yet they don't.
Yeah, we'll get to McTominay. Jake, no Zinchenko, Partey or Elneny, injuries continue to mount up. How did you feel about the team, the lineup? Let's just go for it. Aaron Ramsdale, Ben White, William Saliba, Gabriel Kieran Tierney, Sambi Lokonga, Granit Xhaka, Bukayo Saka, Martin Odegaard, Gabriel Martinelli and Gabriel Jesus. What was your thoughts, Jay, on that lineup?
Yeah, it's still a strong team. Still more than good enough to win. I just wanted to add to what Mitch said about Tyrone Mings. He's always been one of those players that I've never understood how he became a professional, how he made it to be a professional footballer. You know, like, he's physically, you know, he's an imposing guy, but, you know, he's got no technical ability, and he's a bit of a bully. And obviously Mitch touched on it, you know, the sort of the manhandling, you know, the challenge on Saka, you know, to sort of like almost lift him up and push him out of the way. It's just ridiculous. But I was happy with the team, more than capable of beating Villa. Villa are a funny team because they've still got some good players, you know, like quite like McGinn, always quite liked him. And Bailey sometimes can, you know, turn up and put in a decent performance. Watkins, you know, he's got a goal in him. So it was always going to be a tough game, but I thought I was happy, you know, and we pretty much dominated the game. First half, especially, we had completely dominated, didn't we? And it seems like an age ago, but yeah.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
So, yeah, I was happy.
Paul, did you see the match as our token beloved adopted Toffee? Did you watch it for us?
Yeah, I saw most of the game. Yeah, I mean, going back to what Jay Mitchell said there about Tyrone Mings, yeah, I totally agree. I really don't know how Mings has made a career in professional football. To me, he's slow. He doesn't anticipate danger. He gives away silly free kicks. He's way too physical for that role. And I think even Aston Villa fans don't rate Mings either, which quite surprised me at the times. I think one of the things Gerrard got right was A, stripping of the captaincy, and B, dropping at the start of the season. And I think it's worth against Gerrard the fact the centre-half they brought in for Sevilla, whose name I've forgotten, is out for the rest of the season now, so he's had to go back to bring Mings in, and he looks woefully one-paced as well. And yeah, how he's been sort of almost a regular for the England squad in recent years, I have absolutely no idea. And if he's playing an
back is it because he's a left-footed player and we haven't got many options on that?
Yeah, possibly, but there are better left-foot options, and you can compensate for the lack of a left-foot in defence as well, but by a few tactical adjustments. So, I just don't rate him at all. So, just echoing what Mitch and Jay have said there as well. But also, I thought the Villa game was quite a good test for Arsenal, because it would have been easy for Hess to go down conceding the silly goal like that, and the response was almost immediate. So, I think that was to the credit of the team as well. And I think, as Mitch points out there, Villa are a very physical team, and I think under Gerrard, I don't think Gerrard's still quite worked out what style of football he wants to play for Villa and what formation he wants to play. If you speak to Villa fans, they're bemused by the fact that Buendia was not starting week in, week out, as opposed to Coutinho, who they don't really understand why he's been brought into the team, because his best days are certainly behind him. So it's going to be quite a challenging time for Villa, I think, this season. I mean, they bought Lucadinha from Everton, and Lucadinha's great going forward, but he can't defend. I think Gerrard sees the Villa role as his kind of interview for the Liverpool job, which may be coming vacant sooner than anticipated after the event.
He might not want that, might he?
he might not want that at all. So, but yeah, overall, a good performance by Arsenal, a good win, and it kept the winning sequence back on track, which is all you want.
Mitch, the guys that came in, Kieran Tierney, he had a double bite, the cherry on goal. He looks a little bit rusty, doesn't he, because of the injury. But what did you make of Lokonga?
I mean, particularly in the Aston Villa game, I thought he was tremendous. Like, he played so well. I'm a huge fan of Sambi. Like, I love the player. I don't know if six role is necessarily tailor-made to him right now in his career, but I think he's shown that he can play there as of right now, especially when we're shorthanded in that role. And I think he played really well, progressed the ball really well, had some beautiful passes out to the left wing that like went right to feet to Martinelli. No complaints about Sambi's performance against Aston Villa. I think there we saw a little bit of the holes against in the Man United game of like where he is as a number six in his career. But I still think that he's a really, really solid player that I don't think Arsenal fans give enough credit to.
93% pass accuracy, two fouls won, 100% ground duels won. So, yeah, he was one to keep your eye on. And I agree, he's going to be an epic player, I think, just given a bit of time, a little bit of experience. Well, I tell you what, Martinez had a bit of a blinding game, didn't he, Jay? He was like a cat. He was all over the gaff.
Yeah, it was funny seeing him drop that one at Jesus' legs, and Jesus gratefully just popped it in, didn't he? He's always got a thing to say about us, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's. I was talking to Paul last week and said that what we really need is two Jesuses, really, because he creates, but there's no one to quite finish. He's not on the same. Someone's not on the same wavelength as him. If we could have someone who was sort of wired up the same way, it'd be perfect. Paul,
that's Eddie Nketiah.
How do you fit them all in though? That's.
You could play Jesus as a winger and have Nketiah play striker. And like we've seen that when we were chasing the goal against Fulham, we played with a front six and had both of them up there with Martinelli and with Saka, with Odegaard and with Xhaka behind them. And so I think that it can like feasibly work as like a striker pairing for chasing a game, or moving Jesus out to the wing, or moving Nketiah out to the wing. Like we have a lot of versatile attackers. We have like every single player that can play in our front line can play in a different position. So like we can find a puzzle piece that like works together. But I think what the front line that we've been starting with most games of Martinelli, Jesus, and Saka is like what we've got to keep rolling with, because those guys are playing really well at the moment.
Yeah, Paul, I was going to ask you about Xhaka. He's like a different person, isn't he? What do you make of him?
Obviously, you know better than me how this season was Xhaka compared to previous seasons. I mean, as an observer from the outside, he's always been a bit of a loose cannon, a bit of a hothead. You couldn't quite rely on him from game to game. But I think this season, he's really settled down. I think he's been a key factor between Arsenal's in helping with Arsenal's winning sequence this season. I think he's created space to open up the opposition in attacks. He's been comfortable in possession. He's covered well also. He's been, I know the Odegaard, Jesus, etc. rightly get the praise for their contribution this season, but I think just behind that, Xhaka's definitely been one of Arsenal's form players this season, and maybe there's a more maturity about him now. I've been very impressed with Xhaka, as I'm sure you guys have as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mitch, we come to that equaliser, 74th minute. Luiz curls in a corner. Ramsdale was tied up a little bit by Watkins. That reminded me of Leno in the Brentford game. Was it the Brentford game?
But I think this was a little bit different because he was just like straight up pinning him. Like he had his arms like wrapped around him. I don't know what a foul and what isn't a foul in the Premier League anymore. I'm just kind of tired because I feel like. We saw multiple things this weekend of fouls being called because there was a goalkeeper being obstructed. So like I have no clue what's a foul. Like it's so inconsistent game to game. They said that we would get explanations when VAR checks would be in place. They haven't done that. They said that there would be more clarity. There hasn't been. It's been the same product from referees, which sucks because the product of the Premier League is better than it's ever been right now because so many teams are playing so well, and it's getting ruined by just like questionable referee decisions. Like a Brighton player scored the goal of his life the other day and it was called back by like a minuscule offside that didn't even like really affect the play. Leicester scored a goal that was nearly identical to Arsenal's opener against Manchester United that was called back for an Odegaard foul. Yuri Tielemans made a very, very similar foul on that play, and it was not called back. Like, there needs to be, like, very clear lines of, like, what is allowed, what isn't. Make sure that these calls are being called accordingly. Like, it's very weird on how inconsistent it is, because the consistency thing, that seems like the easiest thing. Like, if you don't agree with how an offside is ruled or how a foul is ruled, but, like, if you have a baseline of like all the referees are on the same page, like, oh, this is a foul. If you push a guy over and get the ball, that's a foul. Great. Call that every time. Or if a goalkeeper is obstructed when the ball's coming in, that's a foul. Okay, great. Call it every time. Just do that. Have some consistency with what you're trying to do and the product will be better. have consistency, have transparency, but that we just get none of that. And it's really, really frustrating when you're trying to enjoy a really great product, which is what the Premier League is. Like the games that we've been watching this season have been great. But there's been too many times where the referees take center stage and are the main conversation, and they just shouldn't be. That should never be the role of a referee. And I get that referees make mistakes. I understand, but that's why we have VAR, that we have that double check to make sure that, like, oh no, you got that call wrong, but it's all right, we'll just reverse it. But there's no consistency in it, which is really frustrating.
Jay, do you think that VAR is kind of persuading the referee that he's made a mistake? In his mind, he's getting called over to the screen to have a look. So he goes over and second guesses himself. These things are like a gnat's dick, aren't they? These decisions. It's absolutely ridiculous. Do you think there's some of that?
Well, yeah. Yeah, there is. Absolutely. I mean, this weekend, like Mitch touched on some of them, we saw some absolute shockers. You know, some... If these decisions aren't explained, then they're just giving, you know, the powers that be the power to basically corrupt the game. I know it sounds a bit extreme, but if these people aren't being made to explain their decisions, or we're not hearing any form of conversation between the video assistant referee and the on-field referee, you know, like there was the Joe Willock incident at Newcastle where he was pushed into the goalkeeper, but you know. How is the VAR not seen that one? You know, it's almost as if he looked at the screen but not looked at the full screen, if that makes sense. He's only seen a little bit of what he wanted to see. First and foremost, I don't think you'll find anybody that will say that it's improving the game. Not at the moment, right? Any supporter of any sort of Premier League side, I can't see there being anybody who's saying it's enhancing the game at all. There's more decisions being made, you know, changed from bad to good, right? But with the amount of technology they have, they should get every decision right, especially if these referees are going over to the screen and taking 4 or 5 minutes to make a decision. They should get it right. Mitch mentioned that the Leicester goal, saying it was similar to, you know, the challenge Tielemans made was similar to the challenge Ødegaard made. It was far worse what Tielemans made. He absolutely body checked the Brighton player. And for me, the Ødegaard challenge on Christian Eriksen was incredibly soft. That's never a foul. They offered me, you know, to take it out from this weekend, never to see it again, or just include it for offsides and obviously goal line technology. You know, I'd go for that. You know, your question was, are they influenced? Yeah, absolutely they are. But it should be something that the on-field referee calls for. Not, they shouldn't be called back and told you've made them, you know, unless it is a huge, massive error. It's astonishing that they're making such a horlicks of it, and it's bizarre because these guys are paid a lot of money, aren't they, these referees? It's not like they're paid the 20 quid that the refs get on my vets game. You know, it's these guys that get paid professional, you know, wage. So it's atrocious, and it's this weekend, but you live in hope that this weekend was rock bottom. I'm not saying it is, but
I doubt that very much, Jay.
I know, but you live in hope that they've learned, or they're slowly getting to the point where they start to make an active change and look at the way things are done. And everybody said it, you know, it takes away the joy of a goal. I mean, I suppose, you know, Tom and Mitch, you were the same as me. When that Martinelli goal went in against United, I went absolutely crazy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Lost it.
Because it was such a... The finish, it was such
a... It was fantastic. It was so good.
It was such a finish that it wasn't just like a scramble in the box or rolled into the bottom corner. He absolutely thundered it into that corner. Great finish. And I went crazy. And then to take that away for something so minor... Yeah, you know, it's killing the game. It's killing... Well, no, it's not killing the game. It's killing a key part of the game. You're having to check two or three things, the linesman, the referee, whatever, before you can actually commit to cheering, which is just absolutely rubbish. So if they offered me the chance to remove it from the game this weekend, I would take that.
As you say, as a fan, I mean, I wasn't there. I wasn't paying. Well, I was grabbing beers instead. But as a paying fan, if you're there and that time is elapsing, the joy, the fluency, you've been robbed of it. Paul, what's your version of events on that one?
My opinion would be, as Jay's points out, that the time factor, when you're a fan in the stadium, it's so frustrating that you're waiting 3-4 minutes to see whether the goal is being given or not. Like you, Jamie, obviously, you were going wild celebrating Martinelli's goal on Sunday. We were going bananas where we were waiting for Conor Cody scored a goal in the derby against Liverpool. And for 2 minutes, you jump up and down with joy. And then that nagging dark cloud comes down slowly and slowly and slowly. And you see VAR check. And you know, the longer the VAR check goes on, you know, the less chance of that decision going in your favour. Yeah. And as a paying fan, it's really, really frustrating because you almost at the state now where you never quite know when to celebrate a goal. Nice. Even the days pre-VAR, if the referee made a mistake, it was offside, the decision made about 10, 15 seconds, so you know exactly where you stand. There should be a cut-off point, shouldn't there? I mean, I think Michael Oliver, the penalty Notts Forest got at the weekend took 5 minutes for the decision by the time you got over to see the screen, etc. Now, if you're at home watching TV, that's great because you can get a cup of coffee, you can come back, have a toilet break, and then come back and nothing's happened for 5 minutes. Actually, you can catch up with the action. When you're on the ground, that's so frustrating because you haven't got a clue what's going on. You haven't got a clue what the debate is about. So I just find that incredibly... disrespectful to the paying customer because without fans, football dies. I know a few people now who when a goal is scored, you look behind and they're sat in the chair like that because they don't know whether to celebrate or not, which is, you know, takes away the whole joy of football. Football's entertainment, and entertainment isn't looking at the big screen for 5 minutes saying VAR check and progress. And no one's mind is that entertainment. Entertainment is goals being scored. It's the joy of beating your rivals in a derby match. And that's just been slowly taken away from football as a spectacle. And I think, in my opinion, part of the reason why the Premier League's intervened this weekend about the appalling decisions that were made in so many different games is the concern by the negative publicity, because the Premier League has to generate money. I think it has to make us happy as fans. They just want to keep generating more and more money in England, overseas, anywhere they can get the money in. And I think what they don't want is negative publicity. So this is why they come with this statement now. There's going to be a review. No matter how often I've heard the government say there's going to be a review about this and nothing happens, I have no confidence that the review is going to have any positive impact. From the TV's point of view, VAR's great drama. They love that. From the fans' point of view, it really is so annoying. And I also think as well, why is the VAR in the stadium? Why are they stuck in a cabin in Stockley Park? It's not that the Premier League shows some money, is it? And surely they can afford to set up a box in each stadium. Because, you know, if I'm watching the game in a cabin 200 miles from the match, I've got no idea the intensity, the feeling, what's gone on before. And it just seems to me that these people in Stockley Park are sitting around there trying to find the fault, trying to find something wrong. Mitch, you mentioned that goal for Brighton. I mean, what a fantastic goal that is. That's why I pay my money towards football for, to see skill like that. And to have that chalked off for a ridiculous decision at the offside at the start of the move, it shouldn't be allowed. No.
Well, podcast family, we will get back to the Aston Villa game, I promise you. But obviously, this is a big chestnut, isn't it, we're going through. I agree with you, Paul. Football now is about Sky Television, and it's a television-based sport. So it's being treated as though Sky are the gods and we are just the people that turn up occasionally. Mitch?
The whole point of VAR is to find and correct clear and obvious errors. If it's clear and obvious, it's not going to take 4 or 5 minutes. It's not going to take 4 or 5 minutes. If it's clear and obvious, you're not going to have to zoom in to the like grainiest pixels you've ever seen, like Jesus's offside goal a couple of weeks ago. If it's clear and obvious, you're going to look at it for 30 seconds, be like, oh, yeah, we messed up there. All right, let's reverse that choice.
I totally agree with you, Mitch, because if you've got to keep looking from different angles and all the rest of it, then you're going to find something eventually. You know,
it's confirmation bias. Motion, like, if you want to find something wrong, you'll find something wrong. Like if you look at that Martinelli goal just in itself, you're like, oh, it was a good goal. But if you want to find something to overturn, you'll be like, that Odegaard tackle was a little tough. And you'll try to find something. And if you're trying to find something, then you're ruining the product. That's not what you want. That's not the purpose of VAR.
By the way, people, we're going back to the Villa game. You'll be glad to know, okay? We're going to come back to all this stuff as well because it'll be a recurring theme. But let's go 77th minute. Martinelli strikes back. Brilliant reply, wasn't it, Jay? Can you walk us? Can you cast your mind back that far and remember what it was all about?
Yeah, it was Saka, wasn't it? Cross to the back post. Martinelli took it on the half volley. And again, Martinez made a bit of a mess, didn't he, of the shot. And he sort of palmed it into the back of the net. And we replied straight away, didn't we? It's been a sort of a recurring theme this season, but we've hit back straight away. And it was a great goal, great scenes. Crowd sounded brilliant on the TV. So yeah, more than deserved it. You know, certainly did not deserve that equaliser, not in the slightest. Delighted.
Paul, we were discussing last week about Arsenal's lack of clinical finishing. We saw that to a degree in the Villa game, although we won. So what's the problem? We took that into the Man United game, which we're coming into as well. Still a bit of an issue, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of agreed, Tom, didn't we, that the important thing is to be creating the chances, because eventually, even though they might not be getting converted at the moment, they will be converted eventually. I think in the Fulham game as well, Arsenal created a number of chances that they certainly could have added to the final scoreline there. So yeah, it is. I suppose you might class it as a concern, but I think, I mean, Mitch, you mentioned before about Nketiah, being able to maybe play in the centre and Jesus on the wide. I think the main conversation when Arteta got what his striking options are, maybe. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned, Tom, about the idea of having two Jesuses in the team. I mean that would be superb, wouldn't it? Because I think I've said on this pod numerous times, to me, at the moment, Gabriel Jesus is up there with one of the signings of the season. The impact he's had on the Arsenal team, the whole boost he's given the squad, the fans, the club, it's just been absolutely immense. And I think as the season progresses, his goal tally will improve. And I think he will continue to create chances for other players as well. I think not scoring goals becomes a problem when you're conceding goals. You can win the title by scraping a few 4-5, 1-0 victories to get you over the line. You don't need to win 2-3, 4-0 every week. But once you start conceding goals, that's when you've got to make sure you've got the response in your attack, to come back in games like that, which Arsenal have done so far, conceding against Villa, conceding against Leicester as well. So
we got a couple of comments before we go to the United game. If Xhaka had made that challenge, talking about Tyrone Mings, he would have got a straight red. That's from Jeff Dawes. The ref turned a blind eye to so many of Villa's bad fouls last night. That was from Carol Johns. Right, on to the Manchester United game. I don't really want to go there, but you have to. I'm still gutted by that loss. It reminds me of last season when we lost to them. We had so much on the go. We had so much potential. It's such a good performance. Jay, what did you make of that performance? Because I left the pub. I was gutted we lost, but strangely, I was still upbeat in a way.
It was a performance to be proud of. Like, we absolutely battered them. I was so gutted at the end that we came away with nothing. But also, you could tell. I didn't see too much of the post-match because, honestly, I could not stomach Roy Keane and Gary Neville gloating the way that they normally do. But you could tell in the commentary from Neville just how impressed he was with how we played, and we created so many chances. Yeah, United started the first 10 minutes maximum. I'll give them the first 10 minutes, but for the rest of the half, we absolutely battered them. We absolutely dominated, dictated the play. Zinchenko, obviously, he was chosen ahead of Tierney, and you could see, he was picking up those great positions, pushing into midfield, and we were spraying the ball around, and you'd think we were at home, and United were just chasing shadows. And the only problem was, when the chances occurred, Saliba had the chance in the first half where, if that falls to anyone else other than your centre back, there's a chance that's going in. You couldn't help as well worry about the referee performance when the first 5 minutes, the United centre-back manhandles Jesus, and he clear yellow card.
There was a lot of that going on, wasn't there? Saka and Jesus, they were up on a regular basis.
Yeah, but Saka was giving Varane the runaround, wasn't he? He was physically so good, bringing the ball down, making a nuisance of himself. Overall, I've got mates who are Man United fans, and they couldn't deny it was a smash and grab. Like they nicked the win. Okay, I'm sure we'll get onto the substitutions from Arteta and the goals we conceded. But on another day, we absolutely batter United at Old Trafford, and a performance to be proud of. A performance that makes, I think, the rest of the league stand up. Even though we lost, it was a great example of how far the team's come. And we're in many aspects, we're the real deal. You know, we're not perfect. We still got elements of the team that needs improving. Arteta still needs to improve, no doubt. And I'm sure he'll be the first one to admit he's not perfect in any way. But great performance. It kind of made me want the Everton game to come in 2 or 3 days, you know, just to, because ultimately, like, Paul's probably not going to want to hear it, but I think Everton will get absolutely battered. I think we're going to, there's the frustrations.
Get your headphones up.
Sorry, Paul, but
I've heard all before, Jay, don't worry.
Yeah. It's just, I just think the frustration and the slight disappointment of not coming away from Old Trafford after such an effort is going to, you know, it's going to explode against Everton on Sunday. And great performance, to be proud of. I was the same as you, Tom, frustrated, gutted, but also, like, you know, no United fan can say they deserve that. You know, it was one of those situations where, you know, we all know that you don't always get what you deserve in football. And that was definitely an example of that.
So against the run of the play, Anthony on his debut, what did you make of him, Mitch?
I think he was like exactly what I expected. I think he's clearly a good player. Like that, there's no doubt there. But like, my biggest thing with them buying him is that they very much overpaid. And I think that's generally my view on United's whole window, is that they bought well but didn't spend well. And because they like bought good players, but they overpaid for most of them. And like he's clearly a talented player. He's like a profile that they needed of a right winger, a left-footed right winger. I think that his little tricks are needless a lot of times. I think there's the clip that was going around on Twitter that the Manchester United's official account posted of him going up to Zinchenko, just waggling his leg a couple times and then passing it backwards. And it's like, that's not necessary at all. But it was a really good play by him to score that goal.
Put through Gabriel by Rashford as well.
Yeah, Gabriel stepped out, and then we had a hard time covering that left flank because Zinchenko's playing a lot higher, so we can't really have Gabriel stepping out that high, and especially not missing when he does. Like, if he steps out that high, he needs to get the ball. 100% of the time, he needs to get the ball if he steps out that high, unless he's, like, very, very confident about who's behind him, because that was not a good choice, and it caused Antony to have a lot of space to be able to put that finish in. Solid goal. Like, there wasn't anything to, like, complain about on the goal. Like,
I think Ramsdale made
it was a good goal, other than like it was against the run of play and it was a Gabriel mistake, but
you think Ramsdale made it a bit easy
he tried going near post. I think that Ramsdale getting beat near post might be getting a little too much of it in his head, where he dove near post so he didn't get beat there. I don't know why he made that decision. It was not a good choice. But I think we still got to remember that Ramsdale's so young for a goalkeeper. Like, he'll get there eventually.
Plus, the atmosphere of Old Trafford must be really intimidating as well, isn't it? Eh? Absolutely bricking it when there's a chance for them to go in the lead. So let's get to that Arsenal drew level. It was Saka. Talk us through that, Jay.
Yeah, some good work again. I mean, Jesus was picking up some great positions all through the game, wasn't he? You know, he was, like we said earlier, he was causing the United a lot of issues, and he's got such good feet. Very rarely gives the ball away. The ball, it was like sort of pumped into the middle, like pumped into the center, and Saka sort of rolled it in. And at that point, you kind of thought, you know, great time to score. We're on top. And I thought we'd go on the absolute minimum what we deserved. You know, we'd missed, you know, before that, Ødegaard, what a chance, you know, when it gets put to him, what was it, 5-6 yards out, and he opens his body up and he sort of messes up the shot. And then you've got Saka's chance as well that he puts wide. And, you know, you think, okay, we've missed those chances, but we're back on level terms now, and more than we deserved. I thought Saka had, I thought he had a good game. I thought he caused, it was a good battle with, is it Malacia, left back for United? Yeah. I thought that was a good battle between those two. And Saka looked, there was a few occasions where his dribbling looked good and he was direct, and it looked like the Saka that we saw quite a lot last season. So I thought he played pretty well. And I thought at that point, we're in a great position. United weren't really offering too much, were they? We weren't getting hit on the break. We were controlling the ball, spraying it around, getting into some great positions. And then we got hit again, like, you know, sucker punched with the counter.
All these three goals really disappointed me because they were all, like, as you said, a sucker punch. They came out, we pressed too high, they put the ball through. Great sort of intelligence to do that, and great pace as well. And you have to give it to United. Those goals were taken really well. But we fell for it. It was our Achilles heel in this game. Three substitutes, Paul, were used. We'll have to come to that because there's been a lot of criticism about these substitutions. Did it upset the balance?
Well, I think the end result kind of indicates that it did, Tom. And certainly you bring substitutes on to make an impact in your favour and to get yourself back into the game. And it didn't quite work out like that. I think Arsenal kind of lost their rhythm and their dominance after substitutions as well. Just go back to what Mitch said before about Anthony. Kissing the badge after he scored his goal. He's been at the club for 30 minutes. I just find that incredibly... Incredibly, what are you doing, mate? You know, you're not this lifelong Man United fan. I've been at the club for 10 years. It's 30 minutes in the day. We don't be kissing the badge, you know. Come on. Jay, you made a very good point there about how Gabriel Jesus was targeted. I think about 4 or 5 times in the opening minutes, he was sived down by different people. That first tackle from is Lisandro. Should have been
Lisandro Martinez.
Yeah, Lisandro Martinez. Yeah, that's the one. That should have been a yellow card. Well, Scott McTominay got away with absolute sort of intimidation about the referees intervening at any stage whatsoever. And I think United's tactics were target Jesus from the start and stop him playing. And to some extent, you know, it had an impact, you know, certainly for the first 10, 15 minutes or so. Tom, in terms of the goals United scores, it was just a classic sucker punch. It was almost like the way they played against Liverpool. When they beat Liverpool 2-1 on the break, Rashford just on the last man in the back four took advantage of it. I was kind of wondering whether if Thomas Partey had been playing and had been filling that space in the middle of the park, would those two balls have got through so easily? Because really, this level, you shouldn't be getting cut open by two balls straight down the middle of the park like that. But yeah, I mean, I can understand you guys' frustration because Arsenal were clearly the better side, you know, for the first, you know, for 3 quarters of that game. The Martinelli goal being disallowed changes the game for me because if Arsenal go 1-0 at the time when they're totally dominating the game, I think it's really hard for Man United to get back into the match. And I'm sure it must affect the players, must it? You know, it's been a wonderful bit of skill. You scored a great goal and then it's chalked off for an innocuous offence 50 yards back before the move started. It just seems to me it's not justified at all. I think Arsenal were lucky to play a resurgent Man United because this wasn't a Man United that got chance at Brentford, you know, 3-4 weeks ago. The team has improved. They've got better players than the team now. The team plays far better. And I think, you know, you take the positive out of the game. You know, for 3 quarters of the match, the better team should have won. If you scored, taking the chances, you should have won. If Odegaard is 100% fit, you win the game as well. But, you know, you lose matches. That's football to you. So, and it might take you 2 weeks to come back from it. But, yeah.
I've got an email here. McTominay is a cheat and a caveman. The fouls he gets away with every game without a card is ridiculous. 2 yellow card offences and arguably 1 red offence. Right, so Rashford got his 2 goals. Good for him. See you later. Let's get on to the match stats. We're going to do Man United first and then Arsenal. 10 shots for Man United, 16 for Arsenal. 6 shots on target for Man United, 3 for Arsenal. 39% possession, 61% possession for Arsenal. 310 passes for Man United and 465 for Arsenal. Pass accuracy of 78% for them and 83% for us. 13 fouls as well for them.
I just want to add about the subs. I don't know what Mitch or Tom, I don't know what you think about it, but there was like on the TV coverage and, you know, they made a huge deal about Arteta being naive and he shouldn't have made those substitutions. I didn't have a problem with it at the time and I still don't have a problem with it now. I think he went to go and get something from the game and I think we were losing and I haven't got a problem with what he did and that's what I want my manager to do. I want my manager to be proactive and go to get something from a football match. And I think there were so many, that the reaction, you know, like on Twitter and you know, in the media, they're so led by your Gary Nevilles and your Sky, you know, that your commentary. You could tell that, you know, like, we had gone and won that game, you know, it's almost as if it wouldn't have been allowed, right? You know, after the game, it just felt it was so biased, the whole approach by Sky. And I know this isn't a new thing. I know this isn't a new thing, but the way that they were almost attacking and sort of disrespecting Arteta by saying he's naive, and you know, you've got people like Keane, they haven't had the managerial experience that Mikel's had in the, you know, Arteta's managing an elite Premier League football team. And I just felt it really disrespectful the way that they were talking about Mikel. You watch that game back without the commentary, we dominate even more of the game. We don't, it's not like United had all this pressure in the first 15, it was literally 8 or 9 minutes, and then we took control. Yeah. And then that went all the way until the final sort of 15 minutes. And even after the substitutions, I don't know, you know, we're chasing the game. And the reason that our performance dropped off was because we were sucker punched, you know, and the players were disappointed. Not because of the substitute, because United took the goals well. Rashford took his goals well. You know, like, it's anyone that's played the game or anyone that's followed the game, we've all been in a position where we haven't got what we deserved. And as supporters, you go away from the stadium, or you go away from the, or you're sitting, you know, at home, and you're like, how the did we not get something from that? And you're gutted. So then you put yourself in the position of the players. They're going to be disappointed. They're not going to obviously be able to perform at the highest level because of the disappointment. They're humans, aren't they? And I just wanted to say that about Arteta, because he's been, you know, I think he's been largely disrespected by a lot of people and a lot of parts of the media for those substitutions. But for me, that I would have done the same.
Well, Jay, I did a piece on Facebook in reply, and I just said to this guy, look, if he had won the match with those three substitutions, he'd be a genius.
It's confirmation bias, 100%. Yeah, 100%. Like, I like those subs in the moment where we're down 2-1, bring on three attacking players to try to get the game back. And yeah, you're going to leave yourself a little exposed to where you might lose 3-1 or you might win 3-2. Yep. Like, that's a risk you take. But when you're down 2-1 in a 70th minute in an away match, you're like, yeah, I'll bring on three attacking players. Let's see if they can change something. Let's see what they can do. We win for it. We tried to win it. It didn't go our way, but we controlled the game. We were the better team. It didn't go our way. That's just how it works. And I don't really see why Arteta would be criticized for the subs, because he's going to win the game. He's trying to do that, or he's trying to get something out of it. I know, I have a feeling that if we did score a goal right after we made those subs and it had become 2-2, we probably would have gone a little bit more defensive, taken off one of our attackers, brought on Tomiyasu or something like that, to all of a sudden sit back a little bit more and not go all out attack as much. Like, those subs made a lot of sense in the game state. It's weird to criticize that.
Now, we've been approached by, I think it was Steve. He asked us, do we think it was right that Paul Tierney and the guy called Moss, who was, I can't remember his first name, on VAR, he was the VAR ref. They both come from Manchester. Tierney is 5 miles from Old Trafford. Doesn't it leave the FA open to accusations of bias?
Can leave you open to accusations, but I don't think those are really warranted. I don't think that, like, where you grow up, really, or you grow up like 5 minutes from Old Trafford, so you're like, oh, I'm going to rig Man United games for my entire referee career. I don't know. I think that's a very easy thing to grasp at straws. I think it's a thing that, like, yeah, you could use that. But
although,
like,
Mitch, I must say that Paul Tierney has really driven the knife into Arsenal at times. I think he was in charge of the Spurs game as well, and he wasn't very kind.
Yeah, no, he's just a bad referee. I'm just going to go with that. I think he's just bad at his job. I think that more people need to go with that the refs are just bad at their job, as opposed to there's just some grand conspiracy.
Right, we've got two bits left. Transfer window, it closed. Lot of stick because we did nothing on the last day. Mitch, what was your feeling about our transfer activity? Did we need anyone else? I've got some emails on this as well, but let's have your opinion.
I think I think that we get caught up in like the spectacle of deadline day too much. Like if we had signed Fabio Vieira on deadline day, I think people would have a much different image of the transfer window as opposed to like when we signed him. Because like I'm personally a little disappointed that we didn't sign a winger. Like that is like the biggest thing for me. But like, you know, we did sign Marquinhos so we can see like how he does. He's a bigger question mark. I would have liked a more established one. Like we were very in for Rafinha in the middle of the summer. He would have been fantastic. So I have a higher view of the window than most people. I would put it more of an 8 out of 10. I've seen some people put it as low as like a 5. And it's like, I don't know how you can say that when we've had like 2 serious level raisers come into the team in Jesus and Zinchenko. A young project who seems very exciting in Fabio Vieira. We've had Saliba come back. We had an Nketiah extension. We're cruising towards a Saka extension. Like from every angle, other than the fact that we didn't bring in a winger and we all of a sudden lost 2 DMs a week before the window closed. So all of a sudden we tried to sign Douglas Luiz on deadline day and it didn't work out. Those are the reasons why people were mad about how the window went. And I just don't really see. Like, I understand the criticism of like, oh, we want more depth in places. Yeah, 100%. I agree. But like, I also don't want us to like panic buy anyone. I think Douglas Luiz would have been a solid signing if we'd gotten him for like 23 million. I think he's just a nice little player. I like him. But Villa clearly didn't want to sell him. And we waited too long to like, because we all of a sudden had a panic, like, oh, both of our sixes got hurt. We've just got to buy someone. But we stuck to our price and we didn't budge on that. And I think that's good. And it's a little frustrating to see people like, wow, that was the worst window in our history. I think there's criticisms to be made, but not as bad as some people are making it out to be.
I was the same as Mitch. I thought it was a really good window. I think the disappointment on, you know, not signing anyone on the last game of the season was last day of the window was that Arteta came out publicly, didn't he, and said that we were still active and he was still looking to bring in one or two. So I think that if he'd have just said, you know, say 3 or 4 weeks ago that we were done not signing anybody, then I think the optimism obviously wouldn't be there. So I was slightly different about Douglas Luiz. I wasn't that arsed about signing him. He's not bad, but if the players were fit, we wouldn't be looking at him. So for me, don't go sign him. Sooner or later, you have to have faith in your squad. You have to have faith in the players that you've invested in previously. And you have to go, you know, players like Sambi, who, you know, he's had good performances and not so good, but you've got to give these players time. You've got to give these players actual playing time. So huge chunk of the wage bill's gone. And incomings has been superb. So out of 10, I'd give it an 8. If you can't see that the squad's been improved, then I don't know what you're looking at. You know, we're top of the league. The players that have come in, they're all key members of the squad, aren't they? And you can see with Vieira, he's got ability, and I'm sure in the Europa League we're going to see more of him. So, good window. We haven't got unlimited cash like City. You know, we can't go and splash. I know it might have been, you know, from a transfer point of view, might not be too much, but the wages that Haaland's on, you know, maybe we can't go to those levels just yet. You know, we don't want to cripple the club, do we? So. And we're not in the Champions League. So it does make me think if we had got into the Champions League, how good would that have been? You know, because Arteta came out and said that there was a different group of players that we were looking at. You know, this is the Europa League group, apparently, the Europa League group of players that we've signed. You know, where would we have gone? So, look, the team and the squad are buzzing. I don't care, you know, regardless of the United result. And a major part of that is the players that have been brought in. So great window. And you have to be enthusiastic about the season and the players that come in.
Right. Well, there's a couple of social media statements. One from Simon DC, who's a friend of the podcast, but we don't always agree. We have opposing views. He put, well, there you go. Just when you think that Arsenal may have learned from their previous mistake, like the end of last season. Nah. It doesn't end up that way at all. Unbelievable. And Gunner Girl says, so you Arsenal fans are saying that Edu and Arteta have done nothing. Can Gabriel Jesus and Zinchenko go back? Just learn to appreciate. This is not a dream league. This is the Premier League transfer. Things are not really as easy as you think. And I think that sums it up nicely, Paul, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I agree with what Mitch and Jay said. I think sometimes the hype about the final, you know, the last day of the transfer market is unnecessary. I'd much rather the manager came out and said, right, you know, we've done our business now. We're not going to panic. You know, I think quite often when you make a move on transfer deadline day, you're paying an overinflated fee for the player in the end doesn't really deliver. I think, you know, the preparation for your squad rebuilding's done during the summer months. You shouldn't be really, you know, unless you've been hit by unexpected injuries, in which case you have to react. I think most managers have got the vision for the team. They don't need to be panic buying on the last day of the season, on the last day of the transfer window. They really don't.
We will be releasing a mini pod, audio pod covering the FC Zurich match in the Europa League. If you want to get in touch, it's an Arsenal thing @gmail.com. And don't forget, the audio version of the Gun Room is cropped. The YouTube version is longer, obviously. What are we looking forward to at the weekend? Paul, cover your ears. Hide behind the sofa because we're going to give you it now. Mitch, what's the score?
I'm ready.
I just want a bounce back win. I'd love a 3-0. That'd be great. Or better.
Jay?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go too hard because obviously, Paul.
It's okay, Jay. I'm a grown man. I can take these things. Don't worry.
And I've grew to love him, so I'm not going to go too. I'm not going to go too hard. I want to see a reaction, and I think we're going to get it. Like I said earlier, it's just unfortunate that Everton are playing us next because I think the players are going to be chomping at the bit to get the win. I'd take a 3-0 as well. A win though, you just get back to winning ways. I hope it's a good performance.
I think I'll go for a 2-0. Paul, obviously, you're going to hope for the best. What's your prediction?
Well, I'm confident it's not going to be as bad as the final game of last season when we obviously transferred one. We have nothing to play for. I think you'll find that Everton are a much improved side defensively this season compared to where we were last season. I think we've got the second best defence outside the top six. We've only conceded 6 goals so far this season. And I think you mentioned a few weeks ago, Jay, about Connor Cody, that you thought he'd been a good acquisition for Arsenal, possibly. I think Connor Cody and Jay Tarkowski have absolutely transformed that defence. So, and I had the rare feeling in the derby game at the weekend with about 10 minutes to go, as Erman's on saying, I can't see Liverpool scoring here. We're so solid defensively here. So that's a massive improvement. I can't see it being a high-scoring game particularly. I think it might be the odd goal in three. Obviously, if we get a draw from this, I'd be delighted. That'd be a real measure of how the side's improved. I'm going for 1-1.
We'll let you have that, Paul. we've grown to love you and we've embraced you. Chaps, thanks very much. You look after yourselves and I'll see you on the next pod where hopefully we won't be talking about refs or VAR. It will be because we've had a glut of goals. Because I'm sick.
I don't want to talk about refs.
We'll make a pact. We're not going to do it. All right. Take care, chaps.
That's it. We're all done here. My thanks to Silent Dave. You can find him on Twitter as SilentDave101. That's also the home of Jay, who you can look up as the Bald Gooner. While you're there, check out Mitch at Mitch Piotta and look up his blogs at Pain in the Arsenal. You can cozy up with Connor at ConnorJack2 on the Twitterverse and Paul is at PMacCap. Look up Lauren on LaurenD2710. Shoutouts to Brandon Murphy, Dave Miller of Arsenal Attic, Simon DC, Let's Be Arsenal FC, which is twin to the podcast. Also, check out Ask Devils for opinion and news on all things Arsenal. Please like and follow this audio version of the podcast and subscribe to the YouTube version of the show. Want to say hi, ask a question or take part in the show? It's an Arsenal thing for @gmail.com. More importantly, a big heartfelt thank you to you guys out there for all your emails, your encouragement, your support, whether you watch or listen. Until next time, look after yourselves and each other. And finally, remember this, North London is red. Candy dazzled. I see neon lights.
long.